Paul Gustafson. He's a professor in the Department of Statistics at University of British Columbia. He is also, I believe he's the current past president, according to the website that I read, of the biostatistics section of the Statistical Society of Canada. And he received his PhD from Carnegie Mellon and has made really substantial contributions to Bayesian statistics and inference in using Bayesian statistics in epidemiology and health. So.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. Let me just see if I can get the full screen here. Okay. And okay, I have, like most statisticians, I have nothing interesting to disclose. So there's a likeness of Thomas Bayes. If you type 1702 to 1761 into Google, the first few hits you get pertain to Thomas Bayes. So he's the most famous historical figure with that precise lifespan. There's a textbook sort of version of his theorem that talks about how we go from prior distribution, describing what we think about the world, to posterior distribution afterwards. But what I really want to focus in on today is that it's common to see in observational epidemiological contexts, it's common to see data analyzed under best-case assumptions, such as the exposure is measured perfectly, all the confounders are identified and measured perfectly, there's no selection bias, and so on. But then it's also common to see some qualitative discussion afterwards to say, well, maybe there are some limitations, maybe those assumptions are not quite right. But then, of course, it's difficult to think about how much wider the confidence intervals perhaps ought to be based on those limitations. So the topic of my talk today is to look at whether a Bayesian analysis might let you incorporate prior information about plausible magnitudes of departures from best case assumptions to end up with something more realistic in terms of inference about exposure disease relationships. And the outline, I'll talk in brief about two examples that I've worked on in collaboration with others. One on unobserved confounding and one on misclassified exposure. And then I'm hoping to save a little bit of time at the end to talk about some common themes in these kinds of problems. So the first example is from a study on the possible association between beta blocker use and mortality in patients discharged from hospital with congestive heart failure. The exposure is whether they're dispensed a beta blocker within 30 days of discharge. The outcome is one-year all-cause mortality. There's a big, long list of potentially confounding variables available in these data, but the data were collected for administrative purposes, not research purposes, and there's concern that maybe some confounders that ought to be there aren't there, and in particular, there's concern that even though it's a big, long list, we may not have great indications of disease severity in that list. So a default analysis, as I alluded to, might simply take the outcome and regress it on the exposure and the measured confounders, and then move on to a qualitative discussion about the potential for unobserved confounding. As an alternative, if we want to try and be more formal and quantitative, we might try modeling the relationship of an unobserved confounder with the observed variables, and that would entail prior distributions that quantify plausible ranges for the strength of the relationship between the unobserved confounder and the observed variables. And in particular, prior assumptions about how strongly the unobserved confounder impacts the outcome and how strongly it's associated with the exposure, because that's, of course, going to govern the magnitude of the unobserved confounding effect. Now, one important principle here is that we want to think about or treat the observed and the unobserved confounders in the same way. So, for instance, I'm being sketchy about the model details here, but for instance, we have a logistic regression coefficient that describes the association between the unobserved confounder and the outcome, conditioned on exposure and the observed confounders. We have similar coefficients for the outcome and the observed confounders. So we want to treat all those lambdas the same, whether they pertain to the unobserved confounder or the observed confounders. But the plot thickens a little bit in the sense that we can think about different senses of same here. The one that perhaps is most obvious in terms of setting up a prior distribution, say, on these coefficients, would be to treat them as independent and identically distributed. So we're certainly treating the lambda zero that pertains to the unobserved confounder, then we're treating it the same as the other lambdas that pertain to the observed confounders. On the other hand, another notion of same would be based on exchangeable but not independent as a prior distributional supposition. And in fact, technically speaking, that could be motivated as conditionally IID given an unknown variance, which itself is assigned a prior distribution. But more intuitively, the exchangeable structure would have some dependence which postulates that the lambdas tend to be simultaneously large in magnitude or simultaneously small in magnitude. And we could do a similar treatment for the parameters that govern the relationship between the confounders and the exposure. To go on a bit about this exchangeable prior distribution, the argument might be that it matches epidemiological folklore to some extent. The folklore might say if you adjust for a bunch of confounders and see little impact of that adjustment, then you may feel it's less likely that adjusting for the next confounder coming down the road is going to have a big impact. That's sort of in the same spirit as this exchangeable prior. And the other thing to note is that comparing the exchangeable and the independent prior structures, we can set things up so that they're equally wide in the sense of what they're saying about these individual coefficients. And in the example here, for instance, the important number here is the log 6. So if you like, our sensitivity analysis is saying that we think these relationships involving the unobserved confounder correspond to odds ratios between 6 and 1 over 6. That's our plausible range in this example. And to see what happens on these data, if we do no adjustment at all, we see a crude odds ratio of 0.63 with a highly significant confidence interval to go along with it. So that's indicating or suggesting a protective effect of beta blockers on mortality after heart failure. Once we add in our 21 measured confounders, that shifts a bit toward the null, but not very much, and still highly significant. Then, if we want to come to terms with unobserved confounding using the prior structure we've just talked about, depending on whether we go by the independent structure or the exchangeable structure, we get rather different answers. The point estimates don't move in either case, which is maybe not surprising because we're sort of just doing a sensitivity analysis here. But the nature of that sensitivity analysis is that under that independent prior, we lose our significance. Our odds ratio interval crosses over 1. Under the exchangeable prior, we retain that significance, although, of course, we get an interval that's wider than if we don't consider unobserved confounding. But having said that, of course, as you can imagine, this is really sort of sensitivity analysis, and if I change that 6 on the previous slide, I would get different answers here. Nonetheless, this gives us a way of thinking about how to organize that sensitivity analysis and trying to be more realistic at the end of the day about our exposure disease inference. And just to emphasize, even though these priors are in some sense the same in terms of their width and their range, we're getting quite different answers depending on which structure we choose. And then I think the final thing to emphasize with this example is that when we report intervals like this, we are simultaneously acknowledging both the usual statistical sampling variability that we're always dealing with, but at the same time dealing with this unknown relationship between the unobserved variable and the observed variable. So it's sort of all, both those sources of uncertainty are driving these intervals here. As a second example, I'll go through this one rather quickly to save a little time at the end for some general remarks. We think about a case control setting where the exposure is not measured well. It's a binary exposure subject to misclassification, and the extent of that misclassification, the extent to which the surrogate X star for the true exposure X, the extent of that is governed by sensitivity and specificity in the usual way. A big issue in these kinds of studies are what informs us, what tells us about the magnitude of the misclassification, what's telling us about how far below one that sensitivity and specificity might be. Sometimes we'll be lucky and have some data that really speak to that. I think in other settings it's going to come down more to investigator supposition and prior distribution and plausible ranges for those sorts of for those quantities. And if we do that, again, we're really sort of thinking about a form of sensitivity analysis, if you like. To give a quick example, from a case control study of maternal use of antibiotics during pregnancy and sudden infant death syndrome, the surrogate for exposure is based on self-report on questionnaire. It gives the following data. 101 out of 580 controls are apparently exposed according to the questionnaire results, and 122 out of 564 cases. For sake of illustration, we'll consider three different prior specifications. We'll start with the best case of saying that there is no problem here, that the exposure is not misclassified. Then, in fact, there is some validation data in this problem that suggests the second specification, that in fact the sensitivity is quite low, 0.6, and specificity at 0.9. And then the third specification is trying to be more realistic still, in the sense that the validation data itself is subject to sampling variability. So it's not that we know it's 0.6, it's that we think it's around 0.6 and around 0.9 for sensitivity and specificity. So let's just see what happens under those three specifications. These are point and interval estimates on the log odds ratio scale. If we start with the best case analysis, we get an estimated log odds ratio of somewhere around 0.25, with a confidence interval, 95% interval, that doesn't quite reach significance, so it crosses over zero on the log scale here just. If we admit that there's misclassification using the second specification, we push our point estimate away from the null, which we would expect, because we're undoing the bias caused by the misclassification, and at least in simple settings, the misclassification bias pushes things toward the null. However, and I don't think this is always appreciated, as in many cases, it doesn't shift the lower end of the confidence interval. So we weren't totally sure about the direction of the effect here, and we're still not sure here. And then finally, if we admit that we also don't know the sensitivity and specificity exactly, but only approximately, we get a slightly further widening of the interval estimate. But not very much. So in a way, that's good. You can be honest that you don't know those parameters exactly and not pay much of a price in terms of a wider interval here. But again, a simple example of trying to be more realistic about inferences at the end of the day based on limitations in the data. And then to try and say something a little bit about the commonality in these two examples and other examples of their ilk. A big issue here is identification. Without getting into technicalities, because we have such limited knowledge often about how unobserved and observed variables relate, we don't have the nice statistical property of identified models. That's no impediment to the mechanistic carrying out of a Bayesian analysis, but it has big implications. We're not in the textbook case that we'll get the right answer when the sample size goes to infinity. Point estimates of parameters tend to have a bias that doesn't vanish as the sample gets big, and our interval estimates don't shrink down to a single point as the sample gets big. Just a limitation of the data and the study design. And in fact, the information flow in these kinds of models is not always easy to intuit. And what I mean by that, or I guess an example of that, is that in the unobserved confounding example, those parameters that govern the unobserved confounding relationship have posteriors that are basically the same as their priors. So we're not learning anything about those parameters. So really all we're doing is sensitivity analysis. And if we think that the strength of the relationships are between odds ratios between 1/6 and 6, that's what we think after and before and after we've seen the data. On the other hand, in the misclassification example, we do learn something from the data about sensitivity and specificity. So in a way, we're actually doing, there's actually updating and information there, and we're doing something more than sensitivity analysis. Just quickly, in terms of these interval estimates, so, well, confidence intervals, or more correctly from a Bayesian perspective, credible intervals, again, the limitations of these kinds of models have, the lack of identification has implications. We don't have nice textbook frequentist coverage properties. And I don't really want to dwell on this very much, except to say we can still think about how to interpret and calibrate these things by looking at the coverage in terms of repeated sampling for fixed parameter values, and taking that coverage and averaging it over the parameter space, over different sets of parameter values, and being able to calibrate in that so-called Bayesian coverage way. And that gets a little bit complicated, but it does mean that, or the case, I guess, that I would try and make here is that there's still a way to think about these as scientifically valid, although there's a lot of study, I think, needed to say, well, how do these properties break down? And that gets into an issue of using one distribution across parameters as the prior distribution in the analysis and a different distribution across the parameter space when you're evaluating how well these things work. So there are issues there, and if anyone's interested, there's a paper on my website trying to get at that. And then finally, I think the final thing to think about is that in these kinds of models, you've got estimation errors both because there's a lack of an identified model, and that creates estimator bias. Fortunately, the bias is acknowledged in your credible intervals. And then you've got the usual statistical uncertainty sampling error from a finite sample size. But that has implications in the sense of study design and sample size selection. Once you've got to a sample size that's going to make that sampling error small in comparison to the bias, then sampling more is going to be very cost ineffective. You're going to be spinning your wheels collecting data when, in fact, that additional data isn't going to make this thing go away, and it's already driven this thing down to being negligible. So that's something else that I think has to be thought of differently when we're looking at these kinds of settings. So just to close, I think there is scope to move from doing a quantitative analysis under best case assumptions and then adding qualitative discussion of why that may not be quite right, moving from that to doing an analysis which is completely quantitative and both acknowledging sampling variation and also plausible departures from best case assumptions. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, our final speaker, this is Wesley Johnson. Wesley Johnson is here.